Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we meet the mother-daughter team who built one of the last Frank Lloyd Wright houses he designed before he died.
And a combat veteran on how music composition helped him deal with PTSD.
But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
His impact was profound, and you know, his life was cut short. I think it's important for him and his, you know, his supporters that his legacy continues.
We can argue, we can fight, we can have different ideas. I love that we have left and we have, you know, the ones that are not so progressive. I love it. But we have to come together when it's important for the people of Arizona.
The speech restriction they had in the EPM went too far. And it gave too much discretion to government officials to criminalize and punish speech that they viewed as offensive or harassing.
The old way of doing things isn't working. There are too many burdensome government regulations, outdated processes, and unnecessary paperwork that stands in the way of common sense solutions. This red tape kills jobs.
Are they supposed to violate the law so that they can find out whether it's enforceable or not? Or are they just supposed to comply with the law that they believe is unconstitutional? They're kind of stuck in a Hobson's choice, aren't they?
And joining me to talk about the decision to not launch an ethics investigation against a GOP state lawmaker, state Democrats electing a new party chair, and more are Marcus Dellertino of First Strategic. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting. Sam, good morning to you.
Great to be here.
So, Sam, let me start with you. State Democrats elected their second new party chair of 2025, Charlene Fernandez, former state lawmaker, former House Minority Leader. Good choice going into 2026?
Oh, absolutely fantastic choice. I am over the moon about Charlene's ability to bring people together. And I think that's what the party needs in this moment, not just the party itself, but also, you know, what we're looking at going into an even number year in a very, very important election cycle. I think that she has the trust and the history and the relationship with our statewide officials and can command a room and is going to take the party in the right direction.
How big of a challenge will it be for her to bring the party back together, both because it's been seemingly, at least from the outside, so fractured over the last, let's say, 6 to 7 months, but also because, as you pointed out, there's an election coming up not that long from now.
I think that always, you know, our job, I guess, is to predict a little bit. So you don't really know what's ahead and what new crises she's going to be confronting as party chair. But I think that she does have a demonstrable track record of bringing people together. She led the Democratic caucus in the House, and she has worked across the aisle on a number of issues and really can command respect inside a room and around a table. So I'm extremely hopeful about her ability to lead our party to success in 26.
So, Marcus, at the risk of asking you to wade into internal Democratic Party politics here, you know Charlene Fernandez from having spent time at the state legislature with her. I'm curious about your thoughts at taking somebody as a former legislator and putting them in this role.
She's got her work cut out for her. Listen, Democratic voter registration's tanking, and Republicans are picking – it is blocking and tackling of campaigns. It is the one of the most basic things that you can accomplish as party chair. And it's a huge task for the Democrats to get on task. If, you know, and operating, just to be clear, operating within a caucus down at the state legislature is vastly different than being a party chair. And so, yes, she's going to have to build a coalition. And I would argue the Democratic Party has to change some messaging and pivot a little bit. If she is the Yuma legislator that she began her career being and taking sort of that type of messaging into the campaign and voter registration, then I think she's going to make some movement. If she is in her latter years more progressive of the candidate, more progressive of the messaging, I think that doesn't bode well in Arizona, and I think it'll cause a problem in registration.
Interestingly, she came in this week for a conversation, and she repeatedly brought up rural Arizona, talking about, you know, getting folks in Yuma, getting folks in rural parts of the state sort of on board with the messaging and talked about, you know, needing to talk about issues like the Affordable Care Act, like Social Security, things like that. Marcus, do you think that is that the approach you're talking about in terms of what could be effective?
I think that you have to hunt the ducks where the ducks are. And, you know, look, 10% of Arizona is rural. The ducks are in Pima County and the ducks are in Maricopa County. And sort of that is where your vast movement needs to happen. I certainly understand the attractiveness of the messaging going into rural Arizona. Look, here's the net effect of cuts to Medicaid, and here's why you want to be part of the Democratic Party. But the fact of the matter is the votes just don't exist there. You've got to start messaging in Maricopa and Pima counties.
But when you're hunting birds in Yuma County, they're doves. So I think perhaps Charlene will bring a softer message. And I think that's really why you're starting this messaging and kind of seeing this focus on greater Arizona. Because even though the votes are in Maricopa County and Pima County, I think when you spend enough time in Arizona, you know how important the other 13 counties are to the success of the state as a whole. And, you know, to your point, too, about kind of Marcus, about the progressive or more moderate, I think if you're looking at our top three statewide offices and Senator Kelly, Senator Gallego, and Governor Hobbs, they have all done a really, you know, textbook job of carrying Democratic values and progressive values into a space that can be translated to a more moderate audience. And I think that Charlene's going to take a page from that book.
Do you agree? So it sounds like you're saying she should take this sort of statewide approach as opposed to just focusing on Pima and Maricopa?
Absolutely. But I think that what we're saying is that, or what I'm saying is that it's very much a collaborative effort, that you can't just go. Phoenix will only go as far as Yuma County or, you know, the town of Safford or the overall health of the state. Our 22 sovereign tribal nations, right? All of that is going to be important. And Phoenix cannot leapfrog the success of Arizona as a whole.
Marcus, we heard this week from State Senate President Warren Peterson that he would like to rename part of a freeway after Charlie Kirk. Of course, a lot of Charlie Kirk activity in the Valley over the last several days. There's the vigil at ASU, the big memorial service on Sunday at State Farm Stadium in Glendale. Would you expect that, like, his is a name that we're going to continue to be hearing specifically in Arizona for at least the short term here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Arizona's in a unique position compared to the rest of the nation in that Turning Point is headquartered here. Charlie Kirk lived here. Charlie Kirk had children here. His family's here. And so we have a different sort of perspective on this situation than I think the rest of the country. I talked to friends in other states who were frankly unaware who Charlie was. And I'm not surprised. He's just a little bit more familiar to Arizonans. And so I think this conversation will continue. Certainly for a little bit, and the legislature is going to continue to drive the message, and the Turning Point is going to continue to drive the message.
How, Sam, do you expect Democrats to respond to these kinds of things? Because as we've seen, it's kind of a sensitive moment right now. So, like, do you anticipate, for example, lots of Democrats coming out against renaming part of the 202 after Charlie Kirk?
I think there will absolutely be a contingency of folks that come out against something like that. But I also think, you know, to Marcus's point, we're in this really this important moment right now where we as a community here in Arizona need to process all of these feelings. And I think introducing ideas such as renaming a freeway are something that we do for key leaders, right? We have the John S. McCain Terminal at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. We have Piestewa Peak, right? We name stretches of roads and important, you know, physical monuments for people who are, you know, luminaries in our society. I think what we're doing right now is we're kind of going through the machinations to see if Charlie, is worthy of some type of recognition in that way. And I think that's absolutely a worthy conversation to have.
Well, so Marcus, Sam brought up Piestewa Peak, and I was interested in that because that was sort of the example of the way that naming is supposed to happen in this state. It's does not always the way that happens.
No, that one did not go very well. If my memory serves me correctly,
it did not follow the prescribed amount of time for somebody to have passed. And if my memory serves, didn't really go through that Board of Geographic and Historical Names in the way that it was supposed to.
It was a hardline push by the governor's office. And also, interestingly enough, it was about the time cell phones came online. And so there was a brand of technology that was evolving that politics of late did not fit into very well. So things were recorded, things were said, and it didn't go very well. And I would just say that, you know, and maybe this is way too conservative of me, but I'm over the naming of stuff. I feel like every time we name something, there's some controversy that gets associated with it, whether it was Piwestowa Peak or there was a mountain out west for Charlie Keating, the fourth, that turned into a debacle down at the legislature. There's just a long list of these things. And you know, at some point, I don't know whether we're helping or not helping. Let's just build the building, for God's sakes.
I think the bottom line here is we're at a moment where we need to come together as a community and figure out how we are going to remember Charlie and his, you know, impact on Arizona and the country. And I think that is a conversation that will not be over after Sunday afternoon.
All right. That is Sam Richard. I'm also joined by Marcus Sallertino. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday News Camp continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday News Camp on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting and Marcus Dellertino of First Strategic. Marcus, let me start with you with the Scottsdale City Council. This is an extremely convoluted story, so I'm going to do my best here. A bunch of residents in Scottsdale want the city to sue the state over a law that the state passed that blocked an election that Scottsdale residents wanted to have over whether or not they could block a development by Axon, the company that makes tasers. And the city says it's going to file a notice of claim, which is a precursor to a lawsuit, but doesn't necessarily mean a lawsuit. This seems like this is one of those issues that, at least in Scottsdale, is not going away.
No. But, you know, to put it – and by the way, very good job.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Clearing that
up. Kudos.
You know, and it got convoluted because the city council basically signaled that they want to sue, then went into exec session, came out with a different answer, went back into exec session. I mean, it was just a mess. I would just caution everybody that Axon is not a one-off. This is happening throughout the state of Arizona, certainly throughout the valley. And residents in communities are leery of more apartment complexes, more duplexes, more triplexes, whatever it is. And they want single family houses wherever they live. And that is causing a problem with affordable housing. And so I think that Axon's just the highlight sort of that particular issue. And certainly, you know, North Scottsdale kind of gets that attention. But really, at the end of the day, this isn't about Axon moving its headquarters. This is about Axon being able to build apartments.
Yeah, this really does seem to be about the apartment. I mean, you talk to people who oppose the development, and they say we're good with the headquarters, we're good with the hotel, we're good with everything else. We don't want the apartments. But interestingly, like the project was approved by the former city council, and then they were mostly voted out of office in favor of people who had new council members who come in and, according to the people voted for them, not approve this kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that action that the council took does keep some options open to keep the dialogue moving in a direction. So we'll see where that goes. But I think an important point here for me is that the consternation really is focused on the housing piece of the development. But because it is connected to a headquarters relocation, you have a lot of anxiety, a lot of existential worry in kind of the economic development community writ large, and all of these, Fortune 500, Fortune 50 companies that are seriously looking at Arizona as a place to come and doesn't necessarily want to commit to billions of dollars of investment when this type of trouble is going to be staring them in the face.
Well, Marcus, in fact, when this issue is going through the state legislature, a couple, I think Texas and Florida each like tweeted at Axon, said, hey, Arizona doesn't want you. Welcome here.
Yeah. And it's, again, as I said, it's happening in almost every local jurisdiction I know, whether it's housing for veterans, forget low income housing, just talk about housing for veterans and people don't want it in their community. So, you know, here's the problem, folks. People keep moving here. And if you moved here from California and say, I don't, you know, classic NIMBY, right? Not in my backyard. I want to shut the door now that I'm here. It doesn't work. And we're probably going to get into a different subject matter here, which will show the amount of growth that's going on in Arizona and the amount of infrastructure that we need to keep up with that growth. So we're going to have to find out a solution to this. And frankly, it's going to require some flexibility on behalf of the constituents in the state of Arizona.
Marcus, let me stay with you with the speaking of the state legislature, the House Ethics Committee decided this week, the chairman said he would not have an investigation into Representative John Gillette. He's a Mojave County Republican. He made some anti-Muslim comments. Democrats have filed an ethics complaint. He said free speech, basically, right? We're not going to look into this.
Right. You know, and I will say, I said this earlier, you can take the soldier out of the army, but you can't take the army out of the soldier. And just for perspective and context here, John Gillette spent 35 years in the United States Army, has been overseas a number of times. And so I think his perspective is probably a little bit different than a lot of people. Certainly has probably coming from Mojave County, the most conservative district in the state. Probably has some constituents that might share his feelings, but not reflective of the state. I'd also add, you know, he's not going to run for re-election, so I'm not too sure what the punishment really would have been here that gets you anywhere.
Sam, one of the other things he said more recently was in reference to Democrats, unity is no longer an option. Seems like it's going to be a fun legislative session next year.
Yeah, and I do think that has some very troubling undertones generally. And I just, you know, would be more interested in this conversation if Representative Gillette's YouTube show was licensed by the FCC, just to see what Chairman Carr would do in response to some of his comments. But yeah, I think the comments objectively were something that should be rejected by where we're at currently in our political discourse. I think there is no place in political discourse for what Representative Gillette said. However, I think that the work of and the machinations of the legislature don't really allow for any serious action to be taking place in terms of an ethics investigation.
Do you anticipate, not specifically necessarily these comments, but just sort of the reaction that both Republicans and Democrats have had, and maybe more to the point, the perception of how the other side has reacted, especially, I guess, to Charlie Kirk's assassination. Do you expect that to have an impact next year at the Capitol?
Without question. And I think that, you know, it feels like session is right on top of us. But we still do have, you know, 90 to 120 days until we really
January.
Get into the mix of it. But I do think that is a moment where we're at, and we're looking to our leaders, both, you know, political and otherwise, to really maybe help us make the transition from us versus them to just us. And I think that the more and more we can do that, I think that we'll be in a better place when it comes to January. And I'm hopeful that we can shift the tone very soon.
Marcus, at the risk of asking a cynical political question, is that possible?
I am not hopeful. And I, you know, listen, I'm great at cynical questions.
That's why I went to you with this one.
But I just, you know, I am looking at next session, you know, just looking at the budget numbers alone, there's going to be a brutal fight. And so I think that with that tension, and then in addition to what we're just going through these last couple of weeks with Charlie, I'm hopeful, I guess would be the best way I can put it, that they can come together. I am not I'm not kidding myself, though.
Do you think that there's some amount of, I don't know if trust is the right word, but I'm not quite sure what the right word is, but has something been lost between Democrats and Republicans over the last week and a half in terms of how each side sees the other based on the reactions, or as I said before, the perceived reactions to what happened in Utah?
I think for some of them, certainly, you know, and the response that Representative Gillette was making was in response to Sarah Longori, who's, you know, quite a lovely person, frankly. I mean, sweet as the day is long. And so I think, you know, somebody like her is hopeful and can sort of bridge some gaps. And I think that there's certainly some members on the Republican side that they can bridge. You know, the question is, what is that bridge, right? Is it just going out and having a meal together or a cup of coffee? Or is it, you know, hey, we're going to work on, you know, banning guns, which is not going to happen. So,
yeah.
You know, put it in context of what we're actually asking for.
And given the fact that next year is an election year, I mean, the conventional wisdom is it's sort of twofold that one, the sessions tend to be a little shorter, right? Because people want to get out and campaign and raise money. But also, as Marcus said, it's going to be kind of a tough budget year. You know, the parties are not really seeing eye to eye right now. Like, it seems like it's kind of an interesting and potentially volatile mix for next year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, to maybe recharacterize what I was saying when I was hopeful is I really want to be hopeful. And I'm hopeful in the leaders that really are at the forefront of and really own the responsibility of setting the tone, whether that be the president or, you know, the president of the Senate or the Speaker of the House or the governor here in Arizona. They have a responsibility to really kind of reset the battleground as it sits. And we are simmering in the political space right now. And I think that if, you know, there's anything that I'm hopeful for, it's that we can just all take a collective breath and realize that we all signed up for this work because we want a better place to live, work, and play. And we might come to that arena with a couple of different ideas about how to do that. But we're all there for the same overarching purpose, which is to make Arizona the best place to live, work, and play.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Sam Richard, Marcus Dellartino, thanks to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a new series follows the building of a home using the last plans left by famed architect Frank Lloyd Wright.
But first, Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk will be memorialized this weekend at State Farm Stadium. For some context on Kirk's legacy, our co-host Sam Dingman recently spoke with someone who knew Kirk personally.
Last year, I was doing some reporting at ASU about student activism on campus. And in the course of those conversations, I met a guy named Carson Carpenter. At the time, Carson was vice president of the ASU College Republicans. He later became president. Carson grew up in Prescott, and he's an ambitious guy. He told me that he started taking college courses when he was still in high school. Earlier this year, he graduated from ASU at just 19 years old. And he recently launched a media company called Off the Record USA. During our first conversation, Carson told me about a formative experience. Back in 2021, when he was still in high school, he went to a Turning Point USA event. Charlie Kirk spoke at the event. And unlike a lot of Kirk's events in recent years, this was a relatively small gathering, just 100 people or so. Carson says what stuck with him was that it seemed like Charlie wasn't there to debate politics. Carson said, it felt more like a conversation.
He was just a lot more like personable, I would say, to the point where he was talking about his wife, Erica, personal issues, social issues, faith-driven issues, and that's what the majority of his speech there was all about.
Once Carson got to ASU and joined the College Republicans, he ended up working closely with Charlie Kirk. And so, in advance of this weekend's memorial service for Kirk at State Farm Stadium, I reached out to Carson for a follow-up conversation. I wanted to know more about the impact Kirk had on young men like Carson. When we spoke earlier this week, Carson told me about this event that he and Kirk hosted at ASU last fall. And I asked him what it was like to spend time with Kirk.
It was just kind of his happy place to be with those students. He wasn't debating. He was rallying people to register to vote at that time. So it's a lot different than people, you know, are remembering Charlie for now is his, like, you know, debates and having discourse that way. We walked with him into the middle of the crowd where he had a cameraman and he was just interviewing people. He wasn't debating anyone, nothing of that sort. He was just interviewing people to hear how happy they were to be there.
What was the event?
It was a register to vote event. It was in September of 24, so right before the election, that time period. So, you know, he was getting mauled out there, right, because of all the love and compassion from the students. They were just saying he was such an inspiration. They hoped to be like him one day, speak as eloquently about God. And he just, like, looked down at me and he's like, this is awesome, isn't it? And just had, like, the biggest smile on his face.
So at this event, which ended up having him walk through the crowd and interview people, as you were saying. Did he also give a speech or was the whole thing just him walking through the crowd talking to people?
So he walked in and he went up and gave about a 45-second to a minute talk of just the reason why you need to register to vote, the impact of it that it'll have on the university and every day in their lives. And then he said, let's start having some fun, throwing out some hats, and I get to walk around with you guys. And that was about it. And then he started trying to get out to go talk with everyone with his mic, and just he stayed out there for about, I think, 45 minutes to an hour. So
45 seconds to a minute of talking, 45 minutes to an hour of work in the crowd.
Yeah. And that was something really special about Charlie that's underscored, and I haven't heard a lot of people talk about it, was his accessibility, where a student could walk out at 12 p.m. in the afternoon, hungover from the night before, go to that Charlie Kirk tent on the campus and ask him a question about a social issue, mental health, any type of these range of issues. And it could have even changed Charlie's mind on a lot of these issues. And he was a mouthpiece to the president, to the current vice president now. He was a mouthpiece to all these officials that don't have that type of access to college students. So I think that's something that's also left behind with Charlie, is being that accessible to younger people and people in college, like how I was at the time.
What impact did he have on your views?
I think what he ultimately changed the most about me was just feeling comfortable to speak about Jesus and God in a public manner. I think, you know, before Charlie and before he had gotten popular in this last 2 years, it was very kind of almost out of touch to speak about Jesus and your faith in that manner, even though it's expressing yourself and your viewpoint outward, right? But now I feel like it's been very normalized, and I think a lot of people are feeling a lot more comfortable to speak out about how they personally come to a decision on policy issues, on other issues, because of their faith inside them. Charlie was a prime example of that, because in the last 2 years when he did these Prove Me Wrong tours, faith became a way bigger part of it, and a lot of people started to understand why he actually had those thoughts about these certain viewpoints that could be explained through his recital of scripture.
So let me make sure I understand what you were just saying. You think he could be a model for more people to be open about their faith?
Absolutely. That's why a lot of people after his death have said he's a great American martyr, is because a lot of people view that because of his outward profession of faith, especially in those types of heavily media-oriented environments, heavily broadcasted environments, it's going to create a more comfortable atmosphere for more people to exercise that in their own manner.
But how much space do you feel like he left? Because, as you know, there's a tremendous amount of debate right now about what he actually stood for and how he engaged in debate with people. How much space do you feel like he left for people of different faiths than his?
I think he left a lot, because he was just professing his own faith and why he believed in these manners and arguing it as his moral principles that he sees. So he would express it in that way. Obviously, other people had other frameworks that they believe in, and that's why he was able to engage in those debates and brought forth those debates. I've heard a lot of people say he had divisive opinions, that he was controversial and dividing, but he brought people on college campuses together to debate in the most pure form of debate, where you can walk up anybody, and if you disagreed with him, you got to cut to the front of the line. That's what's different, is he wouldn't silence you if you disagreed with him. He would bring you to the front of the line.
What do you say to people who consider him to have played a role in making the conversation around these topics more extreme? Because as I know you have seen, Charlie is on record as saying that it's worth some people getting killed every year in the name of preserving Second Amendment rights. He's obviously spoken negatively about Martin Luther King Jr., the Civil Rights Act. These are extreme views.
I think Charlie, you know, obviously had hot takes, hot opinions, everything. That is undeniable. That doesn't excuse him to be shot in cold blood, right?
Of course not. Of course not.
And I know Charlie knew that it was very unsafe to do what he was doing, right? I think he knew that, with going in front of thousands of people. He knew he was in danger. His security team knew he was in danger. And Charlie, he broke through it and had the courage to still speak out and still debate. So he knew the risk of what was going to happen for what he was doing. And so I don't think there's any hypocrisy there from his part.
You're saying he felt like there is inherent danger in taking a stand on certain issues, and he was comfortable with that.
Yeah, yeah. I think Jack Posobiec said it last night at the ASU vigil. He was saying that he had told Charlie that, you know, it's probably not safe to be out in front of these things. And he said that Charlie said, "Never, I'm never going to stop."
Do you feel scared? Has this shooting created any sense of fear for you?
No, no. And I don't think it should be. Fear is not an objective thing. It's different for everybody, right? So if it's different for everybody, a collective fear is not a tangible thing. It doesn't exist in reality. It's a part of someone's psyche. So I believe I'm not fearful about this situation. I know a lot of other people aren't fearful about this situation, and it takes courage to move through it. And I'm not worried about going and speaking in front of crowds. I actually did it this last weekend in Prescott. There was about 3,000 to 4,000 people I spoke in front of. And as far as I could tell, it was a pretty small police presence. But
was that a Charlie Kirk event?
It was a Charlie Kirk vigil up there on Saturday. And I had no fear in my mind. There were rooftops that were exposed around. It's in this public square. It's by this courthouse. I had no fear. My faith carried me through that.
Well, Carson Carpenter is the founder of Off the Record USA and former president of the College Republicans at ASU. Carson, thanks for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Jason Phillips thought about joining the military after high school. He'd always had a deep admiration for veterans, including his grandfather, who'd served in World War II. But his mom talked him out of signing up. Later, though, he decided to enlist. The day he went to the recruiter station to sign his contract, September 11th, 2001. He officially signed about an hour before the first plane hit the World Trade Center. After that, sirens started going off and doors slammed at the station. He was taken to a conference room where he watched the attacks unfold on TV. It was at that point, he says, that he knew he was going to war. Phillips was in the Army for 5 years. He was deployed to Iraq for 18 months in 2003 and 2004. He's an ASU grad and the music director and organist at Mountain View Lutheran Church in Phoenix. He'll be presenting his Service to Sanctuary performance tonight, his musical perspective of war and service, including his struggles with PTSD and how composing music helped him through them. That's from an original composition called A Soldier's Symphony. Jason Phillips stopped by the studio recently to talk about his experiences, and we started with his state of mind while he was in Iraq.
In one sense, time stretched out into this. Every moment was significant in a very profound and deep way. Like you start counting like the molecules of time, in a sense. And I experienced some of the best times of my life in Iraq with my fellow soldiers. Sometimes that I laughed so hard I felt like I would never stop laughing. I met so many wonderful men and women, young and old, and I treasure all of that. In every war, there are going to be moments of terrible things. And I don't know who said it or exactly where I read this, but war is like 90% tedium and then or 95% tedium, and then 5% is terror. And I think that's the experience I took away from it, is that every part of life while I was in Iraq just seemed amplified.
It sounds like that would be, given that, hard to then transition back to civilian life when your time in the military was done.
I thought it was going to be smooth. I felt very grateful to have left my military service without ever having been physically wounded, and that the further I got away from my military time, I would transition smoother and smoother into the next stage of my life. My wife and I got married shortly after my military time, and we moved to Southern California, about 5 miles from Disneyland, and that changed everything because they had fireworks every night, and it just brought back flashbacks and nightmares that I was already suffering from. And that was the beginning of a very difficult journey.
Yeah, what was it like for you before maybe you recognized that you had PTSD and before you were able to get help for it?
When I first returned from my time in Iraq, my mother was the first to notice some things. This was right after I returned, that she thought might be symptoms of PTSD. I had never heard that term before. And so part of my presentation that I'm going to be doing talks about how I resisted that. I also felt like, who am I to seek treatment for stress when I have people that I know who lost their lives and lost their limbs? So PTSD did not ring true to me, and I resisted that diagnosis for a long time. But internally, I was struggling with almost like what I would say was a malignant tumor of emotion and confusion, and it just got worse over time.
Philip says about a decade ago, he suffered what he calls a real break from reality and had a complete mental breakdown. He says he had to look at himself and recognize there was something inside him he needed to address, and that if he didn't, he'd lose everything, including his life. Philip says he's grateful to his wife and family for sticking with him, and that music was also a huge help in processing what he was dealing with.
To try to pull myself out of that lowest of low points, I returned to school. I was pursuing a PhD in music education. And in one of the first classes that I took after I had enrolled, I was introduced to a composer named Daphne Oram. She's a British composer of electronic music. And as a woman in the middle of the 20th century, she faced some discrimination. Men didn't think she should be involved in electronics. So on her studio wall, she hung a framed picture of her favorite quote from a novel. And it said, "We also have sound houses." Now, she was referring to herself as a woman and a composer having a sound house just like the men did. I immediately – that quote hit me like a lightning bolt. And I thought, what I need internally are sound houses that I build for myself out of music. And then become this internal shelter built out of my melody and my harmony and my form. I went home that very day, sat down in my – office and composed one of the first songs that will be presented on my program. And I just felt so different as I was doing that. And after that, I felt so grounded. The turmoil internally, the voices, the visions, they all went away. And all I had was music. And that set me on this journey of discovering that music wasn't just a sound house, but really the sound sanctuary that helps me to find healing and find meaning and peace and purpose after my experiences in and after war.
So you talk about building sort of a house of sound, like, what were the components of that house that were so meaningful to you? I mean, I would imagine it wasn't just any, you know, any tract house, as it were. Like, it had to be something that would speak to you in a particular way or make you feel a particular way. What was it about the music that spoke to you so well?
It's nothing specific about the music itself, but that for me, music represents the deepest, most meaningful personal human experience that I've had in life since I was a child. Music struck me from the moment that I first heard it. So for me, connecting to that part of myself intentionally to create this sound house and part of a sound sanctuary and create something that was ordered out of the everything that war had disordered, that was the process that helped me. And I feel these pieces inside me. I mean, every composition leaves me with the impression that I have built something in me that is there permanently.
What does it mean to you to be able to perform these pieces for other people? You're obviously composing them, as you say, for yourself. But what does it mean to you to be able to perform these for other people and maybe help them the way these pieces helped you?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot recently. And it's helped me to understand – every part of this journey has helped me understand more and more what I'm doing here. And I realized that if I can give people a deeper and more nuanced and more thorough understanding of psychological war wounds, then I will have found meaning. If I can encourage some people to help combat veterans, then I will have found meaning. And if I can encourage my fellow combat veterans to find their own sanctuaries and to embark on this healing journey when they're at their lowest point or hopefully before, then I will have found meaning.
All right. Jason, thank you so much for this conversation. Thanks for sharing your story. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jason Phillips is the music director and organist at Mountain View Lutheran Church in Phoenix. He'll be presenting Service to Sanctuary, featuring some of his original compositions this evening at the church. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Frank Lloyd Wright is a household name in Arizona, designing buildings nearly until his death at the age of 91 in 1959. Some of his structures have been built based on his design since his death to varying degrees of success. And our next guest built the very last one. Debbie and Sarah Dykstra are a mother and daughter team who undertook the massive job of reconstructing River Rock House in Willoughby Hills, Ohio, after finding the plans underneath a seating area of another house he'd designed nearby. The original building site was still available, designed around a single poplar tree. So they built it. And it's all documented on the new series from the Magnolia Network called The Last Rite. I spoke with Sarah and Debbie more about it as they sat in the completed River Rock House.
Back in the mid-50s, Lewis Penfield had commissioned and was building his first home. The Ohio Department of Transportation announced the creation of Interstate 90, which was going to destroy his first home that was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. So they went back to, the family went back to Mr. Wright and asked for a second set of plans to be drawn up for an area on the property a little further south. And they went back and forth and signed contracts and such, and then waited and waited a little longer. And then they heard that he had passed away.
Right.
But in the process, they decided to move Interstate 90 a little further north. So that house was not destroyed and we still have it. We still own it ourselves now. But lo and behold, a week or so after his funeral, those plans for River Rock, which ended up being his last archived residential set of plans, arrived at the Penfield house. And so they were kind of like, okay.
Frank originally told them to build the same house.
He did.
And then they said, no, but we don't want the same house.
Yeah. Lewis is like, I'm an artist too. I need to build something different. So we need a new set of plans.
A new set of plans. But they never ended up building that River Rock house. But you two did. Tell us how you got involved in this.
Well, we were all living in Florida at the time. We're from here, but we were all living in Florida at the time. And my son was moving to New York City, and once he got there, he told us that, you know, he really wanted to bring his son back here. So he asked Sarah to start looking for a piece of property or a house that had an in-law suite so I could go back and forth. And the first thing when she pulled up realtor.com or whatever that's called was this property. And so we mulled it over back and forth and put our house up for sale, signed for this one, and they both transferred or happened basically within 2 weeks.
My goodness.
And then we all came back.
Okay, wow. Okay, so let's talk about taking that on, because that is quite an undertaking. The original site was still there, and that was important, right? Because if you know anything about Frank Lloyd Wright, right, like you know that he designed to the location almost to a T, like he wanted to build into the environment. This was built around a single tree?
It is. It's built right around a poplar tree, also known as a tulip tree. And it's a certain degrees off of that tulip tree and about 19 feet away from it, the point of it is.
So it's still there. So you start to, I guess, conceptualize how you're going to do this. What was the first step? I mean, I understand the plans themselves were actually pretty difficult to read, right?
Yeah, we found the plans, many copies of the plans in the bench seating in the Penfield house. And our poor architect for about 5 months was trying to put the drawings into CAD and having to read those. And then with our production team, they got in touch with the Avery Library out of Columbia, and they ended up rescanning them for us. And now they're crystal clear, and it's amazing the detail that's on those set of plans.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that made it a lot easier. But it's not an easy undertaking. Tell us a little bit about trying to carry this out using the right materials, using the right techniques. I mean, there's code to be taken into consideration now that probably wasn't in existence 60 years ago.
Sure. We wanted to make it so that it missed a lot of the things that Frank is known for, the saggy cantilevers, the leaky roofs, those kind of things. So our team that we got together was adamant about making it the best Frank Lloyd Wright house that could be made with 2025 technology. So we put, you know, more steel in the roof, bigger block on the interior to support that steel. We used double-paned glass everywhere except for where we have a mitered cornered glass. But we stuck with the footprint of the plan, the size of the rooms, all of that was kept right with the plans that Frank drew in 1959.
Right. I mean, he was famous, or maybe infamous, for being a real stickler about where things go and how they should be built, right? Did you feel a lot of that pressure?
There was a lot of that pressure. Like, I don't even know how to describe it. My mom's sitting here going, it just took a heavy sigh thinking about it. And, you know, along the way, we just discovered that we would not try to alter things. And we learned things like, why? We would sit back and go, why did he do that? Why did he do that? And then we'd learn, oh, that's why he did that. That makes sense now. Mm. And so we had a lot of those discoveries throughout the project, which was really interesting.
Tell us about one of those moments.
So I would say the biggest discovery that we had was with the location of the house. You know, we were so close to the poplar tree. We talked about moving it away from the poplar tree. Should we take the poplar tree down and put it in the same spot? Should we pivot the house on that point and put it more towards the river, like so it's parallel to the river? And my mom at one point said, you know, you're trying to be as authentic as you can, so you need to do it with everything.
Yeah.
That was in October of 2023. And in September of 2024, our architect, Rob Shearer, called me up and he said, you need to set an alarm for the first day of fall at noon. And I said, well, why? That sounds weird, but I will. And he said, well, if we put the house in the right spot, the shadow line, because I just put in the solar movement into CAD, if we put it in the exact right spot at noon, there should be a shadow line where the window wall meets the stone cap.
on the second
floor. And so I was like, all right, so I'll do that. And I was out here and I was sealing wood. So I was up on a ladder, kind of looking down on that spot of the house. And it was like 11:45. And I'm sitting there watching it going, there's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way. And it hit exactly right there.
Oh my gosh.
And it was just like, you know, chills, call mom, tell her to come down here. Maybe a tear.
I was going to say, did you have a tear or goosebumps there? My goodness.
Yes, all of them.
Wow. So, I mean, you're sitting in the finished version of this house, right? I wonder, I guess, your takeaways from this. Like, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation will say, you know, any unbuilt home linked to Wrights that was not, you know, directly built under his eye is not a Frank Lloyd Wright work. It's derivative, that kind of thing. Like, do you feel like you've really fulfilled this?
Yes. And I invite anybody from the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation to come visit us and tell us where it is not or how it is not.
We actually had one of the trustees here during the project, Mr. Bing Hugh, and he absolutely loves this house. And his favorite house is actually the Penfield house. So he was really excited to come out and see this one. I think it's an important part of his legacy, too. You know, there were plenty of houses that were built after Frank died, or there are houses, the Penfield house, he never came to the Penfield house while it was being constructed. So there's policies and then there's opinions.
Fair enough. All right. Well, congratulations. What an undertaking. That is Debbie and Sarah Dykstra joining us. They are the general and co-general contractors of River Rock House. The new show is on the Magnolia Network now. Debbie, Sarah, thank you both so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us about this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Have a great day.
So, Lauren, I guess if you ever find yourself in Willoughby Hills, Ohio, now you have something to do.
I got something to do, and I got to go there at noon at that specific time on that specific day, and I want to see it.
Sounds pretty cool. All right, that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. A reminder, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter called Radio Heads. You can do that at theshow.kjzz.org. And, you know, while you're online, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at kjzztheshow. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.